The subtitle is The Extraordinary Story of Citizen Diplomacy on the Russia-Alaska Frontier. Could you talk about that a little bit, how citizens helped thaw the ice curtain?
In 1948, the United States and Soviet Union at the time agreed to ban any sort of travel across the Bering Strait because of the Cold War, and the effect was to isolate Native families on either side of the strait for 40 years. And in the mid-1980s, there began a drumbeat for change led by Alaska Natives who wanted one last opportunity to reunite with their relatives. And so a lot of Alaska and Russian Far East average citizens took advantage of the times to renew relations across the strait and reopen cultural, educational, scientific, and business relationships. And it really led to a 30-year period of very good relations across the strait. Unfortunately, things have slowed now in part because of international politics and lack of airplane links. But I think there's still a lot of goodwill between Alaskans and Russians.
But were there a lot of folks who, you know, still knew their families on the other side?
Yeah. Governor Cooper and I participated in what was called the Friendship Flight, Alaska Airlines 1988 flight from Nome to Providence. And most of the people on the plane were elderly Alaska Natives who were looking to meet long-lost relatives on the Russian side. And sure enough, when we landed in Providence, many of them did connect with long-lost relatives. And that really continued over this 30-year period of good relations between our countries.
Did they find anything had changed culturally between them? You know, one spending all those years under the Soviets and the ones over here?
Yeah, it's pretty complicated, the relationship between Russian Natives and their national government. They weren't treated very well on the Russian side. In a lot of cases, the Soviet Union simply closed down Native villages on the Russian side because they couldn't afford to keep them going and tried to consolidate them into regional centers. Also during the Soviet period, there were a lot of subsidies from Moscow that were poured into the Russian Far East, so it attracted a lot of non-natives from Western Russia to come work out in the Far East. That's changed dramatically now. The population is down dramatically in the Russian Far East as a lot of those Western Russians went back home because there's no more jobs in the Far East. So things are pretty grim in the Russian Far East these days.
What was it like, you know, spending all these years of, you know, living this, you know, talking to these people and, you know, watching it happen?
Well, I think thousands of Alaskans participated in this era, in part by hosting Russians in their homes. I know the Kenai area was a big focus of Russians, in part because of their interest in oil and gas development on Sakhalin Island in Russia. Both Kenai and Soldotna established sister city relationships in the early 90s with Russian communities, and hundreds of Russians came to the Kenai for cultural exchanges and business and oil and gas training. And a lot of those friendships continue, though it's much more difficult these days just because of the logistics of getting to the Far East.
What differences did you notice in the lifestyles of Alaska Natives and the Native people in Siberia there?
Well, in the Russian Far East these days, there's not much of a cash economy. Most of the Native villages are back to their subsistence roots, where they form hunter cooperatives. They pool boats and engines together, and they identify the best hunters in the community who go out and hunt walrus and whale to feed the community. And there's not much cash. There are few opportunities except for school teachers. And so there's some similarity with Alaska villages, but I think Alaska villages are much more prosperous than they are on the Russian side.
Oh, wow. I know that there is Siberian Yupik language. I don't know about other indigenous languages there, but do you find that they have persisted?
They do, but unfortunately, I think the native languages on both sides of the Bering Strait are starting to erode. Our experience last summer when we were in Russia is that there are very few families that speak the native language at home. They mostly speak Russian. It's interesting to see 14-year-old Russian kids in the Far East walking around listening to their iPhones and music, just like kids on the Alaska side. And so I think that the dominant culture is really eroding the traditional native cultures, really on both sides of the Bering Strait. There are predictions by linguists and specialists in native languages that they may be gone in a couple of generations, which I think is quite sad.
What do you see as the future relations between the Russian Far East and Alaska?
It's certainly different times these days than it was in the 80s when you had Gorbachev in the Kremlin, who was encouraging better relations with the West. That's certainly not the case these days with Mr. Putin, and so relations are much more challenging. But I do think the model that Alaska and Russian Far East citizens created in the 80s shows that there is a way forward, that we need to keep talking no matter how bad relations between our two countries get. And certainly native exchanges and cooperation in a changing Arctic are two possible examples of cooperation.
Could you tell me more about your visit to the Kenai Peninsula coming up?
I'll be there on Thursday, October 5th. I'm speaking to the Soldotna Rotary Club at noon. And then the Soldotna Library is holding a public event where I'll do a presentation on the book with about 30 PowerPoint slides from the era from the book. Former borough mayor John Williams has agreed to introduce me. I've known Mayor Williams for many years through political circles. And so it's great that he's going to talk a little bit about the Kenai's relationship with Russia and then introduce me for the presentation.